The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
Yeah, definitely a step up, but, you know, that could be perhaps maybe the script just worked. Maybe it was just the fact that it had Eric Roberts being all Eric Roberts-y.
The terrible Australian, B. Jemine.
Why doesn't the vampire just leave? It's not like that he's being held there against his will. And we've seen him a few times on top of built-on roofs. Like, why does he just piss off and leave?
It contains coarse and explicit language.
The housemate dude, I was like, why the f*** are you dressed like Constantine? That was just weirding out the whole time.
Mature themes.
You know, it's your wedding day and everyone always has cold feet and they sort of... This is kind of more of the extreme version of that kind of scenario. Like, should I marry a serial killer or not?
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
G'day everyone, this is B. Jemine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome to episode 23 of Podcasters of Horror, the podcast where we dissect film and TV horror anthologies. And with me, as always, is my lovely co-host, the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy, how are you?
Hey, hey, good to be back, as usual, for our Podcasters of Horror show.
Indeed, indeed. But, we're back on Podcasters once again because we have a pretty awesome show to talk about this time. Because we, 'cause 2 months back, Marcy, we did the first season of Channel Zero, which was Candle Cove. And we decided that we would cover a season from that show every 2 months. And it has been 2 months since that episode. So for this one, we're going to be tackling season two, which of course is No End House. And we also have a very special guest joining us to talk about this season with us.
Yes, we do indeed. Very excited to have this special guest back podcasting with us, but their first time on Podcasters.
Indeed, indeed, because they've been on a couple of episodes of our other shows before, particularly the King's Own podcast, but this is his very first appearance on Podcasters of Horror, and that, of course, is our good friend Josh Plock. Hello, Josh, how are you?
Hey, what's going on?
Not too bad, not too bad, my friend. What's been going on in your end of the world?
Man, this is pretty terrible.
Yeah, understandably so. Understandably so. So, at the moment, it feels like we're living in Australia. It's probably pretty much the best thing for us to do right now, at least for Marcy and I. So,
I mean, not with the weather this cold, but sure.
Well, that is true, too. That is true as well. Like, it is freezing cold down here in Australia, and it's just getting colder and colder by the day. But I guess we'll just have to manage with it. But we're happy that you're back with us on the Super Network, Josh, particularly making your first appearance on this show to talk about this season of Channel Zero. But before we dive into season two, tell us your overall thoughts on Channel Zero. Did you only just watch this season of the show, or have you watched the entirety of the series?
Oh, I watched the entirety of the series. I remember it was back when Sci-Fi Channel was doing their big rebrand, when they were trying to get back to their roots briefly, and they said they announced a horror anthology. So I love horror anthologies because I've always seen them as like, that's the most bang for your buck.
Yep.
You know, a bunch of stories for one movie or show or comic, whatever. So I was there. So I watched every season. And then when it got canceled, I was like, oh, come on, really?
Yeah. And I guess that's a shame, too, about this show, because already going through two seasons of this show already, it's definitely up there as one of the strongest horror anthologies that I've watched. I mean, I haven't watched all of them, but the ones that I've seen, this is definitely one of the strongest ones. But we'll get straight to talking about season two of Channel Zero, which goes by the name of No End House.
I'm the better version of you. Probably better at being you than you are.
Everybody who goes in describes it totally different. Gets in your head.
Oh, I'd be walking down this, like, long hallway. And there would always be someone hiding from me.
Which was directed entirely by Stephen Pitt. I probably butchered his last name, so please forgive me. And the season was based on the story of the same name by Brian Russell. And this season stars Amy Forsyth, Aisha Dee, Jeff Ward, Seamus Patterson, Sebastian Pigott, Jess Salguero, Melanie Nichols King, and John Carroll Lynch. And the plot summary for this season, which I'm reading off the series' official Wikipedia page, is a young woman and her friends visit a house of horrors, only to find themselves questioning whether it is a tourist attraction or something more sinister. Now, Josh, before we sort of dive into the nitty-gritty of the entirety of this season, tell us your initial thoughts on season two of the show, which is No End House.
My initial thoughts were, I remember when I saw it, it was after Candle Cove had wrapped up, and I was just blown away by Candle Cove, because I was already a fan of the source material, and they took it and just went a whole different direction, and that blew me away. So, to this day, I still haven't read No End House, because illiteracy challenges us all in different ways as adults. The fact there was going to be a season two, I was excited about it, so... You know, I was there, turned up. I was really particularly excited about that it was a haunted house story, because I've always liked haunted house stories, whether it be, you know, The Uninvited all the way up to The Changeling. So the fact that this one was kind of like a haunted house story, but then as I watched it was a haunted house story where the characters kind of created the horror themselves was fascinating. John Carroll Lynch is just one of those great character actors who has a great screen presence, and this performance was just... He's one of the two MVPs of this series because he did that great balancing act where he was like a Karloff-esque Frankenstein monster where he was a monster, but yet he cared at the same time and he had that fine line to walk and he did so brilliantly.
Oh, he was one of the standouts, absolutely. Oh, yeah. He's so good.
And Marcy, I know that for a fact that you said to me like the other day that you actually had read the original short story that this season was based on. So tell us your initial thoughts on No End House.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was actually quite a long short story. So I skimmed bits of it, but kind of read like initially like what it was. So yeah, it's quite different, but I actually think like from what I'd read, the way they kind of handled this was a lot more interesting. I think the stakes were kind of higher in this regard, and they kind of expand a little bit on like what that house could be. So yeah, I didn't even read like a plot synopsis or anything. I just went into this without knowing really what it was about. So once it kind of unfolds, I was like, oh, this is really interesting. And then like when you see this house, like you don't spend all that much time particularly in this house, but what it does, like you're very confused and unsettled and wondering what the hell's going on. And then when things kind of like get really just like, what the hell is going on? Shit does hit the fan. But at its core, it's definitely a story. Well, it's trying to sort of, you know, it's about combating your trauma and grief. And it definitely has all those like undertones there. And the core of the story is between the character of Margot and her father. And they were both like, as mentioned, like John Carroll Lynch was excellent, and Amy Forsyth as Margot I thought was really, really good.
very grounded, and they had a very like natural sort of chemistry as father and daughter. As the story goes on, like, it gets more and more heartbreaking, and we get some very shocking moments. Like, what this house does and how it kind of operates is it's really unsettling. Like, you're like, I don't think I want to be in that situation. So I really liked this. I was very much invested from the get-go. Bede, what about yourself, brother?
Yeah, well, as we, you know, you and I both know, Marcy, I was a big fan of the first season, Candle Cove. Mm. And I wasn't sure what to expect going into No End House. Like, I knew it was about a house, and I thought it'd be more kind of like this, you know, kind of haunted house type of story. That's kind of the initial thought I had going into it. And in a way, it kind of is. But what's interesting, though, is how the sort of the series kind of sets everything up. Like, we get this opening scene where we see this woman who's like hiding out somewhere in the street, and she sees this very interestingly designed house, which is it is a house, but it has this unnatural feeling to it, especially for the fact that it's entirely from top to bottom painted purple, like this really dark purple, which kind of makes it stand out. And you see her running to it, and then of course someone comes out running after her, smacks her in the head, and you're like, what is going on here? And then of course it goes into the character of Margot's story, and we find out more of her background and her, and the fact that the year prior she lost her dad, and also like her relationship to her friend Jules, played by Aisha Dee. And then of course they sort of get caught up meeting with other friends and then go to No End House, which is kind of like this mysterious house that is kind of like everyone online is talking about. It only shows up once a year, but it appears at random places around the world. Like, it's probably there for a little while, and then it just completely disappears again. Which, I again, like Candle Cove, is one of those great kind of, you know, urban legend type of scenarios that it kind of draws you in. And then once they actually go inside the house, like, each of the rooms is so unsettling in how they're sort of designed, and from, you know, from the production design, and also what happens to these characters in the room. Particularly, there's one in particular when they go into room two, which is like this big room where this guy wearing a mask is like wandering around them, intimidating them, and it's all done entirely in one long continuous take, which makes it kind of stand out from Candle Cove, because even though it does have that sort of grounded approach as Candle Cove does, filmmaking wise it's very different, because with Candle Cove that one was more kind of very static with its kind of filmmaking style, but this one there's a lot more sort of tracking shots, a lot more steady cam, so there's a lot more ambition in the way how it's presented here on a filmmaking level, which at times kind of reminds me of the horror film It Follows in terms of the use of its steady cam. Especially when it's going around the neighborhood. And I'm thinking to myself, like, okay, they're going through this house. All these creepy things are happening. Like, where is it going to go from here? And then once they sort of leave, they realize that they're in this kind of very off-kilter world that is not what it seems. And then, of course, Margot discovers her dad is alive, but it is not her dad. I'm like, okay. At this point, I'm getting a bit of an idea of what's going on. But then the series kind of knows how to kind of shift its story and take it into a direction you don't expect, because there's a scene where basically her dad, while Margot's asleep, goes up to her, puts his hands on her head, and you kind of get these visions of like her mum, and then her mum starts to slowly kind of morph into this purple kind of haze, and then all of a sudden the mum sort of spouts out from this black goo in the basement. I'm like, okay, where is this going? And then of course he goes downstairs, rips off her arm and starts eating her, and I'm like, what is going on here? And then it just gets even more surreal and much more interesting from there, because it's an interesting take, because again, I haven't read the original short story, so I can't, you know, compare the two. But what I really liked about the series overall is it's a story that kind of dives into so many different themes about grief, about loss, about even addiction, and also memories. And it kind of tackles all these different themes in such an interesting and unique way that actually made me sort of like think that, you know, I am, that really unsettled me as a viewer, because that's the great thing about you know, Channel Zero so far, just based on these two seasons. These aren't shows that kind of driven, kind of scare the audience, like through, you know, say jump scares or and stuff like that. Not to say that there's anything wrong with those, but this is one that's more interested in really kind of getting under your skin and kind of showing you these scenes that are happening and just kind of unsettling you. And also it has this kind of surreal quality to it as well that I really appreciate as a season. And overall, I think the performances are great. It's definitely Amy Forsyth's show. She's fantastic. And I was watching this series and I'm thinking, like, where have I seen this actress before? Because I, like, she felt very familiar to me. And then I sort of was looking up her filmography and I realized I've seen her quite recently because she played the best friend of the main character in the Oscar-winning Best Picture film Coda. So I recognized her from there. But of course, John Carroll Lynch, who's, you know, a well-known character actor, he is absolutely fantastic in this season. And of course, his character, even though, yeah, he's kind of this kind of manifestation of Margot's father, but I do like the fact that you did a good job of bringing this up, Josh, is that he is kind of like, he is a monster, but he goes back and forth between what he wants to be. Like, he needs to give in to his urges by eating Margot's memories. But at the same time, though, he kind of recognizes what Margot's going through and realizes what he's doing is wrong. And I think that's a really interesting sort of dynamic between these two characters. And for me, their relationship, it really is the heart of the series.
That was a very long-winded...
I kind of realized that, and that's why I needed to wrap up, so other good people could talk. So if anyone else has anything to talk, please feel free to share.
Yeah, I mean, I'll send the question out to you guys. I'll ask Josh first. There are a lot of very, like, unsettling and just messed up visuals. Are there any that stood out for you that you were like, oh, my God, I really don't want to look at this right now?
There was during the initial walk through the house where, you know, this is where I'm expecting something like, you know, The Uninvited or House on a Haunted Hill, traditional haunted house stuff. And then, like being mentioned, the guy with the mask just kind of being intimidating. And then the thing that kind of looked like a preform version of her father. And it was all amplified by Jeff Russo, who's my second MVP of this season. I'm currently loving his reworking of the Star Trek theme right now on Strange New Worlds, but his music that he conducted for this is perfect. So it was very ominous, but very trippy at the same time. So it fit very well, where it's like, oh, there's something creepy, but also unsettling kind of creepy about it. So that really kind of amped it up at the same time.
Yeah, it's especially weird because you don't know, like, what you're really going to expect or get in this house. And I guess they kind of went for almost like an escape room kind of vibe more than, say, haunted house, even if that's how, you know, kind of came off as, like, if you were looking it up or whatever. But, like, that I don't know if it was the first room where there was, like, the molds of their faces and stuff. And that already was, like, weird and then... like, it just kept getting weirder and weirder, and it's like, what the fuck is up with this house? It's definitely, the house definitely feels very unsettling and unnatural. Bede, what about you? Was there any moments or parts that you were like, oh my God, this is too much for me?
Yeah, well, I guess for me, it really is the scenes where, you know, the characters, like, you know, the dad, when they are eating memories. I believe there's, like, this thing that pops up even before we find out all of this. There's like a sign that says beware the cannibals.
Yeah, so we're kind of alerted to that, like, when they first get in the house.
And I was interested, it's like, oh, is this going to be a cannibal story? But it kind of takes it in a different spin. Like, these are cannibals, but they're not just eating just flesh, they're eating memories from people. But the memories kind of form, like, for example, like I said, stated before, like the first time Margot's dad does this to her, he takes away her memories of her mum, or her image of her mum in her memories, and then it kind of manifests into this kind of form, like, that looks exactly like her mum, and then he eats that form. As we see throughout, like, all these other scenes where we see the characters kind of, like, these monsters kind of eating memories and all that. Like, some of them do get very gross and creepy. And there was one in particular, I believe it might have been in the fifth episode. And I saw the scene, I'm thinking, like, I wonder how Marcy's going to react to this when the dad, in his desperation for food, decide to take away the memories of Margot's dog or a puppy when she was young. And then when the puppy comes out, he just eats like this small little puppy. And I was like, both kind of was like, I found it quite upsetting.
It was very upsetting. I didn't like that at all. I'm like, no, you crossed a line, show. That's just not allowed. Because then at a later point, you see he takes another memory because like, as we can sort of talk about more of the story, all he gets is an apple. I'm like, you could have taken a fucking apple. You didn't have to take the fucking puppy. Dude, what's wrong with you, mate? Like, fuck you.
Yeah. Also, like, the insides of all these memories.
Yeah, they're like little, like, they look like almost like gross popping pearls.
Yeah, or even like apple pie. That was like the first thought that went to my mind. It's like, oh, it's like you're biting into these memories. The inside is like the inside of an apple pie.
Yeah.
Which I'm now sort of disgusted everybody now. They'll never look at apple pie the same way ever again.
You'd think American Pie would have put you off apple pie.
Well, that too, but, you know, it has been over 20 years since that incident, so now something else has come along to replace it. But even then, Marcy, like, other little moments that kind of creep you out, but I'm glad you brought up the first room with, like, their sort of, like, their heads that are kind of like these art pieces and that. But every time they pass through that room, the designs of their heads get more elaborate and more creepy. Like, we see like something inside their head is popping out in another one. And also there was this one image in particular that really creeped me out. And I don't know why. It's like they go in, Margot goes into this one room and there's a mold of her dad's face, but the mold is pulsating. Because we know in the series that Margot's father died due to an allergic reaction. And for quite a while...
That face she sees is like that reaction he would have been having.
Yeah, like his like eyelids getting sort of shut.
Like and all puffy that. And swollen and stuff, yeah.
And I like the fact that the series doesn't show us what his face looked like after that for quite a while until he starts to come into the real world. But we do get hints, like, again, that sort of mold of the face on the wall, but also when they go into another room, which is clearly looking like Margot's living room, and there's like this guy wearing a face that looks like her dad's, but it's all kind of very crusty and had an ash kind of look to it. And it's also very kind of, you know, very puffy, and you kind of get those hints about it until you actually see it later on in the series. But yeah, it's just moments like that. They're also really creepy, but also, The family that's in a cage in the middle of a cul-de-sac, that's another really, like, bizarre and creepy image that, as the series goes on, we learn more about, and we're like, oh.
Yeah. Was so nonchalant about them when we first saw them, should have been our clue of, okay, there's something wrong with that guy.
I mean, yeah, like, because when Margot goes with, like, her friend Jules and JD, they meet a guy called Seth in line going into the house. And I'm sorry, but anyone with that, like, cheekbone structure, they're not going to be a good nature. You know, they're going to be bad. Like, that guy had the perfectly molded face. And he just gave off, like, very creepy vibes. So you're always very unsure of this guy. So as they're kind of progressing, you feel like maybe he knows more than he should. Yeah, when you see that visual of, like, the family in the cage, but then you kind of understand, like, when they get into this house, something manifests in there that will then feed off their memories. And we find out that Seth basically lives there. And if his backstory is to believe, like, he was in foster care and stuff like that, so he's probably got very bad abandonment issues and stuff, and he lures people into the house to feed it and whatnot, but then ends up kind of really liking Margot. But yeah, you kind of work out, like, he wants to stay there, he wants to keep it going, and he's like, oh, you know, there's a way to do it. And, you know, when Margot ends up being stuck back in the house with her dad, and she kind of then just feeds him, like, a light memory every so often as a kind of a way to, you know, survive or whatnot. But then obviously Jules goes back in the house to get her friend. But we don't know the extent of things, like how much Jules actually lost, because she was kind of like hypnotized by the manifestations that needed her memories. And she gave a lot of it up without quite realizing it. And it was interesting if you think back to like that first room where they see the molds of their face and then the lights go out and the molds have changed. And JD's like, oh, mine's still the same. Well, that's because like his manifestation, which was the version of himself he wanted to be, never got to feed off his memories. Instead, he killed him to try and take his place, which I think he then realized was a stupid mistake because he has nothing to eat after. But then you kind of see the extent that everyone's kind of lost memories, and you can see how people can become like a shell of themselves. And I think it's a really clever way to sort of kind of tell a story that like we all have trauma and things that, you know, or grief, but we can't just live in that trauma or grief or, you know, whichever thing you want to look at. Like, you kind of have to move on. And it's not healthy because you will become a shell of yourself if you just, you know, end up drowning in that. So I thought it was like very clever way of kind of telling these stories as well. But I've kind of droned on a little bit, so.
But you're absolutely right. And I like that sort of all these kind of quote unquote monsters that feed off all these people have something personal to do with that person themselves. Like with Margot, it's her dad. And with like Seth, who it's like the family, I guess he always wanted that wanted to feed off him. And like with JT, it's himself, because what takes over his place is, I guess, the version that he wished he could be. And
yeah, like the smooth talking womanizer type of dude.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And although I keep thinking, like, what was Jules? Because Jules is one of these interesting, because it's like this big, round, almost egg looking thing with something obviously inside it.
Yeah.
And the series kind of never really sort of indicates what that egg is supposed to represent for Jules.
Could have been a manifestation of guilt or something, but it never really kind of explains it. And we don't get too much. Like, we know that she feels a lot of regret for kind of leaving Margot and, you know, not helping her when her father passed and stuff and da 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 da. But we don't get like too much. We don't know anything about her family or anything, because she is like a main character along with Margot. So it was a bit, I wanted to know a little bit more about her backstory, like why, like what was that manifestation, why kind of thing. But it hints, but it doesn't quite tell us everything, I guess.
Great imagery.
It was very like messed up imagery, that's for sure.
Exactly. And I do like when later on in the series when she comes back, because like, again, like I guess her arc throughout the series is that she does feel that guilt about leaving Margot behind while in her grief, because she didn't feel like she could handle being around someone like that. And then, of course, now that Margot's went back into the No End house, she waits a year and decides to go back and get her.
Well, she has to, because the house only shows up once a year.
Well, that is true. But it also, in a way, kind of to atone leaving Margot behind before, and she's not going to leave her behind again. And I guess when she meets the egg again, when she comes back, of course the egg somehow brings her inside the egg, and of course she cuts herself out of the egg, which is a pretty gross little moment there. And she's like covered in blood and everything. But I think Aisha D, who I discovered in my research after watching the series, is actually an Australian actress. I think she did a really good job. But I can definitely see your point though, Marcy, about even though she's a major character, like the series doesn't quite dive into more of her backstory as much as it could have, especially like her relationship with her mom and also her sister. And like, what are these other memories that she's missing? And also I do like that the series kind of ends on at least when it comes to the questions of the series leaves on an ambiguous note, is like, yeah, your memories get eaten away by these monsters, but when you kind of go back to the real world and see, say, your mom or your sister and all that, do those memories start to slowly come back, or are they permanent? And I like that the series never gives an answer to that. Like, we never know if it is permanent or not once you step back outside into the real world.
Yeah, we don't know. Or do they form new memories over those things? It doesn't tell us, so we don't know.
Yeah, exactly. But I do like that when Margot does go back with her dad, she decides to write all of her memories down in a book And then instead of letting her dad just willingly take it, she starts telling him her memories, like which memory in particular he's going to take. And then, of course, once he does steal it, she completely has forgotten that memory. And then in a way, it kind of changes the dad's arc as well, because he starts to realize how important these memories are to Margot. And of course, he makes the sacrifice at the end to, like, the only way that he could free Margot from being in No End House is he decides to have Margot kill him and then drown himself in the pool.
Pretty much. It's a very like full-on and emotional scene as well. Even though, like, it's not technically her dad, it's still, you know, it's like that goodbye she needed, I think.
Yeah. For all intents and purposes, like, is not her dad, but it's eating her memories and becoming something like her dad, which really has that emotional impact you needed for when she put him into the pool and finished him off. It added that extra layer to the story.
Yeah, because you could see, like, throughout, like, he's definitely fighting within himself as well. Because he doesn't want to be doing these things, and clearly, like, that manifestation of who her dad is obviously cares for her. So it definitely adds a lot of interesting stuff to it. So I thought it was really interesting. It just, yeah, if kind of other characters had a bit more like Jules, I think it would have been almost perfect, like, at least for me. But I thought this was really good, really, like, just intriguing. And you kind of, yeah, like, it leaves you kind of not sure what's going on. Like, when sort of through that first episode and they think they left the house and then the dad's there, I thought maybe, like, the house gives you an alternate reality or something like that. I didn't think, like, they're stuck in the house until, like, I kind of saw, like, the number 6 show up. And I'm like, oh, wait, this is room 6. And it's like, ooh.
Indeed. And also, it's just like there's also an interesting subplot in this film series, where we discovered that someone in the group that joins, like, Margot and Jules and that, there's another character who kind of has gone through this house before and is searching for his wife, who's somewhere in the house. And he goes looking for her. And then, of course, she's lost all of her memories and basically decides to kind of take her against her will back to the world. So hopefully, you know, again, like we asked, like, does the memories come back once you go back out into the real world? And it doesn't quite work out well for him. And I think that was an interesting kind of subplot, because the series kind of sets up, you think, oh, he's going to be a huge major character. And then, of course, the dad kills him. Then in a way, like, Jules kind of takes over that kind of thing, because she's doing the exact same type of thing by going back in to find Margot and rescue her.
Yeah, it was interesting, because then we see, like, you know, the woman that was his wife is, like, just a shell, pretty much. And, yeah, this guy...
She's married to somebody else now.
Yeah, was married to someone else, so she's clearly been in there a while. And, you know, they kind of had the thing on their arm that they, like, put in there, like, this is not real. So it's, like, a reminder of what this house is and stuff. But this guy was, like, he wanted to be Dan Stevens in The Guest. Like, that was his look.
Exactly.
It really was. I was like, why does Skylar look like Dan Stevens in The Guest? But yeah, I didn't expect him to actually get killed either. I thought he'd get out, but there you go. The series just doesn't hold back. And I interrupted you, Josh. Please go.
Oh, no, you're cool. I know. I particularly liked in the first episode when they're going through, when they still think, oh, this is just a haunted house, and they see that panic-stricken woman who just, like, runs by them, gives them this kind of blank look of, why are you here, and then runs out. That should have been their cue of, okay, there's something going on here. It also reminded me of this haunted house I went on when I was in middle school or something. And it was a class trip on this haunted hayride. And there's this one woman who was a good number of years older than all of us, who just sat in the back, and we're like, well, who are you? And she's like, oh, never mind. And she's, of course, the one the monster comes and gets in during the ride. And I'm like, well, yeah, she's the one who's not part of us. So I can see them in their brain going, oh, she's just a scare actor here to, you know, freak us out to think, there's something scary up ahead.
Yeah. I like how we sort of don't get explanations for things. Like, what the hell was that dude in the mask?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And I also like later on, JT, like, he says, like, he went into the last room, or he thought was the last room, And he asks, "Oh, what did you?" And Seth asks him, "Well, what did you see in there?" It's like later on he describes, like, this is again like one of the great things about this season is sometimes characters describing things that happen to him and it just ends up being unsettling. Is that he saw the guy with the mask again and he took the mask off. And I believe, and I could be wrong, so because it, you know, has been a few days since I last seen the second episode, I believe that happened in, when he said he saw his own face underneath that mask. And I think something else happened as well, but I can't quite remember. And I think, to me, like, hearing something like that, it definitely unsettles you as a viewer when you even hear characters kind of offhandedly talk about these weird experiences that have happened to them.
I mean, it makes you think, like, how would you go in that house?
Yeah, well, I'll try to make it all the way. If I knew the outcome would be, like, going into this kind of giant world, like, that looks like a neighborhood where all these kind of, like, some kind of aspect of myself materializes into this form that becomes a monster that eats your memories, I would probably take the better option and try to reach for the exit. But that's just me, though.
How would you go in there?
I don't care how much the cost of admission is, I'm out.
But how would you go, Josh, in there?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm the stupid adventurous type who'd be like, oh, no, let's go all the way to the end. But I think I would be smart enough to realize once I get through that, wait a minute, I'm still in the house. There's no way this dead person who I watched die is here. No, there's still something weird going on. I wouldn't be, oh, okay, my dad's here. He can't eat omelets anymore. He must have COVID. Okay, cool. And then after a few episodes, realize, hey, wait a minute.
Wait a second.
I'm kind of interested, Marcy, what would you do in this type of situation?
I mean, I'd go into that weird world, and then whatever my manifestation is, and Lord knows it'll probably be something disturbing, I'm going to be like, look, just take all my really bad memories, eat them so I don't remember them. Then I'll kill you, leave the house, and don't have my shit memories. But would that fundamentally change who I've become as a person if I didn't have those memories, as shit as they are? It's a dilemma.
Yeah, that is a good point. And I was thinking when you were saying, like, oh, just take away the bad memories. Like, yeah, I guess that could be one benefit. Like, if you got bad, horrible memories from events that happened in your life, you'd be like, oh, I could probably do without those. But at the same time, though, and as you correctly said, Marcy, those moments, like, definitely would have helped shape you as a person.
Mm.
And if those moments are gone, like, would you still be the same person as you are? Or would you be a completely different person now that those moments are no longer part of your life?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of like something it was kind of put in there as well. But like if you went all the way to like the inside of the house, we'll say like room 6, do you just like completely kill your manifestation and peace out and be like, I conquered this house, fuck you guys?
And I guess that's an interesting thing about this series is like it pretty much is this whole season is a metaphor for grief. And I think with, like you say, Marcy, her finally killing her dad, it's her finally accepting her grief, saying goodbye, and moving on. And also, I guess that is the big thing about this house, is you're being, like, coming across something that is a bigger part of you, whether it is a manifestation of your dad, or the family that you always wanted, or the person you always wanted to be, or your guilt.
Mm.
But if you somehow overcome it, then your life will be for the better. And in a way, is this house, in a kind of a messed up way, kind of helping these people confront their demons so they can move on?
I mean, it could be. I think Seth looked at it the wrong way.
So like when Q took the Enterprise to the Delta Quadrant to meet the Borg for the first time, kind of like that.
But yeah, I think also, once again, like it, kind of, the show kind of shows that even though you have this house that's basically this living organism that feeds off people's memories, it's the human character that ends up being the real monster with Seth. No, and ever since you, and since you told me about the cheekbones thing, Marcy, I cannot unsee it now.
I wish I had his cheekbone structure. Sorry, what's the actor name? Jeff Ward?
Jeff Ward, yes.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a perfectly chiseled face.
Indeed.
Like, too perfect. My goodness, why is your face so perfect? I mean, like, dude, I'm jealous. I wish I could just, like, look so perfect and pristine like he does.
But in the end, we find out he's a total asshole because pretty much he brings a woman in, like the house feeds off her memories. And during that time, it's like he, as he says in the show, like, I'm just a serial monogamist in a very messed up type of way. And then once that woman becomes a complete blank slate, he leaves them and gets a new one. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, at least he gets a house. I'll give him that. Here, have a house.
Yeah, and see, someone with those cheekbones, of course they're a serial monogamist.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I think I'm picking up like a bit of a theme because season one, I feel like, was definitely about a lot of like forgiveness and letting go. And this is kind of like that letting go of the grief and trauma. So are the other seasons like that? I mean, I guess we'll find out.
Indeed. Well, I don't think you should say, Josh, because we don't want to for Marcy and I to be spoiled about where the series goes from here. But I got to say, though, based on the two series so far, Channel Zero is definitely a very great and unique horror anthology TV show. And yeah, it sucks that, you know, it only had four seasons, but, you know, at least compared to other horror shows, it's got more seasons than most others. I mean, it has more seasons, Marcy, than Masters of Horror, which we did originally for this show back in the day.
Yeah, true. Very true. And I do like how, even though they have different feels and they're very different stories, like they do feel very kind of reality-based. Even though they're very fantastical in their own ways, it feels very grounded. And I quite like that. And the idea that they base these off like creepypasta stories, which is just essentially like people's just written stories for like, you know, online urban legends. Like, I thought that sounds a bit silly, but the way they've actually crafted and expanded on the stories is actually really clever. I think that's actually the right way to do it. I haven't seen like that Slender Man movie, but I'm sure that did nothing new with the material. And I know Slender Man is kind of messed up because of the girls who attempted to kill their friend and whatnot. And that documentary is very interesting. But I think they've actually kind of handled, you know, sort of retelling a creepypasta in a good way because it kind of really expands and adds dimensions to it.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I think, like you say, like, even though it does have that sort of grounded feel of what Candle Cove has, but like I stated earlier, like, I do appreciate that on a filmmaking level, it does feel very different from Candle Cove as well, with all the different steady shots and all that. And I was sort of looking up, like, Stephen Piett's previous directorial work prior to this series. Actually, after this, Marcy, he directed two episodes of the miniseries The Act,
which I thought was quite good, to be fair.
And he directed a film called Uncle John. That was like his first film. But at the moment, he's kind of just doing more mainly television. But I do like the fact that, again, like Channel Zero, having one director direct all the episodes, it kind of gives the season a much more singular vision throughout all of it.
It's very consistent.
Yeah. Mm.
And like the cinematography was really good. Like, I thought it was just so well shot. There's some really intriguing like visuals and how they kind of set up those shots, I thought were really good.
Oh, for sure. And I think, it's just a creepy, unsettling show that kind of, again, goes out of its way to unnerve you and get under your skin rather than, say, you know, delivering like a shock moment every now and again.
Definitely.
But I guess this could be a wrap on season two, No End House. Josh, give us your final thoughts on No End House and also your rating for the entire series out of 5. I mean, this season, I should say.
Like I said, I haven't read the source material for it, so I don't know how, judging by seasons 1 and 3, I'd say it's, you know, does its own completely different animal with it, but I thought it was great. For me, it proved that season 1 wasn't just a flash in the pan, one-hit wonder, that, hey, this series actually has legs, and like you said, with the one singular director, that means we get, you know, one singular vision for the entire story arc. And I think it was great because it was its version of the classic haunted house story where you kind of went in and instead of, the ghosts, the monsters popping to scare you out, it was, hey, come and live here. All the people you lost and everything's great in here. you wanted to be in that haunted house, but, you know, at the same time, you didn't realize, hey, you're just a food source. If not for the monster, then for Seth, who just wants companionship. So either way, you're in trouble. And I love the score. I thought the acting was fantastic. Yeah, it was a great season. I'd give it a 4.5 out of 5.
Oh, awesome. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for No End House.
Yeah, definitely agree with everything Josh said. I think, yeah, it's a really interesting and different take on sort of, you know, haunted house or escape room type thing. And it gives us a really compelling story with great sort of performances who really, I think, really enhance those characters and the relationships between the characters. And it's quite compelling from beginning to end. And I really enjoyed it a lot. And yeah, like you said, the score is really, really good. There's a lot of unsettling moments and it's got such good visuals. And yeah, I think like it is a very slow burn season, but I just found it really intriguing. I like that kind of stuff. So yeah, I really, really enjoyed this. And I give this one 4. I want Seth's cheekbones 4 out of 5.
I'm going to give it 4 out of 5. As well, which is the same rating I gave for Candle Cove. I think for me, I do, as much as I did love Candle Cove as a whole, I think for me, this is definitely the more interesting of the two. Like, at least for me on a thematic level, because this is a season that really dives into so many different themes. And I think it finds a really interesting and compelling way to tackle all the different themes that's within this story. It's very unsettling. I can definitely see some people's complaints that it might be a little too slow-paced in parts, especially to Candle Cove. But I think with Candle Cove, I guess my big criticism of that season was, at least towards the last two episodes, it kind of felt like it was rushing through the story in the last two episodes because it had to wrap up everything. But I feel like with this season, it actually had a good rhythm, like nothing kind of... It felt rushed at all. Like they did a good job at sort of telling the story in a way that didn't feel like it had to rush through it. Although I will admit though, when it got to episode 4, I'm like, oh, is this where the story is going to end? Cause it feels like you could end the season right here and not go any further. But I did appreciate with the last two episodes that they did go further with it, because it had a lot more interesting things that happened in both those episodes. And so, yeah, I love the sort of the pacing of this one. Like, it is a good slow burn of a season. And it has many creepy moments. The performances are all great. Again, Amy Forsyth and John Carroll Lynch in particular are fantastic. And visually, it's just a great looking season as well. So, yeah, 4 out of 5from me.
Yeah, it's very damn solid.
Indeed. I really like it. Indeed. And so, yeah, that is a wrap on our discussion of season 2, No End House. And I hope all of our listeners enjoyed it. And we'll come back in about 2 months' time to talk about season 3, which is Butcher's Block. So I look forward to talking about that season. And of course, thank you, Marcy, for always being a very awesome co-host, as per usual.
You're welcome. And for next month's Podcasters of Horror, we will be doing a double feature of 2 horror anthology films.
Indeed. So you'll have to stay tuned for those ones. Because we do have a list of ones, because we might have to change a couple little things around. But we'll talk about that after the show. But Josh, in particular, thank you so much for coming back on the Super Network and joining us for your debut on Podcasters of Horror to talk about this season of the show.
Oh, I love hanging with you guys.
Thank you.
Indeed. Yeah, so we'll, before we sort of wrap up the episode today, Marcy, where can people find us on the internet this week?
Yes, for all things Podcasters of Horror and the Super Network, go to supermarcy.com. You can find all our podcasts and posts and stuff there. And you can find all our links and stuff for our socials at the link tree, which is linktr.ee/thesupernetwork. And I'm sure if you look up the Super Network on your socials, you'll find us. And be sure that you are subscribed to Podcasters of Horror on your podcast player of choice, and please leave a rating and review if you enjoy listening to the show. We'd love to hear your feedback. And if you want to find me personally, I am available on Twitter at SuperMarcy, and I'm also on the Letterboxd at Super_Marcy. So there you go.
Awesome. And Josh, where can people find you on the internet this week?
I write for thehouseofgeekery.com, so I have stuff probably popping up on there, usually reviews of old horror movies or grindhouse movies. You can pre-order my book, We Are Gotham, from McFarlane & Company, and I'm on the Twitter machine at DarkKnight125. Look for the picture of Dracula.
And if people want to find me personally, they can find me on my Twitter page at twitter.com/bjamine or my Letterboxd account at letterboxd.com/bjamine. And of course, you can find all my work over at supermarcy.com with my reviews and columns. So yeah, that's the end of this episode of Podcasters of Horror. We hope all of our listeners once again enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you all next month for next month's show. See you, everybody. Bye.
Bye-bye. Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN. Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised. A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi, so just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show. Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months. Please use the link surfshark.deals/supernetwork to take advantage of this amazing deal. You can also find the link in the show notes. Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy shark do 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 do. Surfy shark do 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 do. And now back to the show.